You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. In this podcast, Richard Shannon talks about the importance of quality in healthcare, the Be Safe program at the University of Virginia, and its impact on patients and healthcare professionals, as well as his thoughts on how healthcare quality can be improved. Richard Shannon, MD, is the Executive Vice President for Health Affairs at the University of Virginia. He is responsible for aligning the key components of the UVA health system to achieve a goal of becoming a top decile academic medical center. Dr. Shannon spoke at the Wednesday, January 13, 2016 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Vice President Rich DeMong. Our podcast is entitled Pursuing Excellence in Healthcare. Here's Rich DeMong.
Let me introduce our speaker today. As Margaret said, it is Dr. Richard Shannon, the Executive Vice President for Health Affairs at the University of Virginia. He's responsible for the key components of the University of Virginia's health system to achieve the goals of a top-notch academic medical center. Prior to joining UVA's health system, Dr. Shannon served as a chaired professor and the chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Prior to his appointment at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Shannon was the chair of the Department of Medicine at Allegheny General Hospital at Pittsburgh. Dr. Shannon received his bachelor's at Princeton and his MD from the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. He did his training of internal medicine at Beth Israel Hospital, his cardiovascular training at Mass General, and was a chaired professor and associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School before becoming a chaired professor of medicine at Drexel University. Both at Harvard as well as Drexel, Dr. Shannon received numerous teaching awards, and his investigative interest is in the area of mitochondrial metabolism and heart failure, specifically in the field of energetics and the progression of heart failure. Dr. Shannon's lab was the first to discover the beneficial cardiovascular actions of incretins, which form the basis for an LLC that he founded. Dr. Shannon's pioneering work in patient safety is chronicled in the chapter First Do No Harm in the book The Best Practices, How New Quality Movements is Transforming Medicine. His innovative work has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, CNN, and CNBC, as well as it was the basis for an hour-long program on ABC's 2020. Dr. Shannon is elected member of many honorary organizations, including ASCI, which serves on several editorial boards. He served as a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics at the University of Pennsylvania. He is currently a member of the boards of directors of the American Board of Internal Medicine, the Pennsylvania Health Care Cost Center, and he's a teaching fellow at the Institute of Healthcare Improvements, and he's on the Kaiser Foundation board as well as the Kaiser Foundation Hospital Plan board. Dr. Shannon. So.
Thanks, Rich, for that kind introduction, and thanks to what I think I can refer to as all my friends at the Charlottesville Senior Center. This is my third visit in the last 4 months, so I think pretty soon I should sign up for a membership. I'd like to think I'm not quite yet at the age threshold, but maybe maybe age is not the final determinant of membership. And thank you for having me. It's an honor to present to this group. And I'm going to continue on a theme that many of you heard me discuss when I was here a few months ago, and that is the critical economic imperative of healthcare reform. We hear a lot about healthcare reform today, largely in its political context. But healthcare reform in America has really nothing to do with politics. Politics happens to be, I think, the sideshow of healthcare reform. Healthcare reform is really about two unassailable trends that the nation faces that if we can't fix them, will really dramatically alter the outcomes for many, many Americans. And those trends are the baby boomer demographic, the idea that every day 10,000 Americans turn 65. That's true today and will be true every day for the next 13 years. The ranks of Medicare will double in the next 10 years when really it's been over the last 50 years that the Medicare population has doubled. That demographic is unassailable. There is no way that can be avoided. And the second big trend that causes us to think seriously about reforming healthcare delivery is the fact that people today suffer from very different diseases than they suffered from 50 years ago. So when I was a kid, diseases that were rampant were things like scarlet fever. When's the last time you ever heard of a case of scarlet fever? You know, I was born in the 1950s and was in that first wave of people that got the polio vaccine. Infectious diseases, which were the bane of developed countries' existences when I was a little kid, have now given way to a series of chronic diseases. No longer does 7 days of an antibiotic treat your hypertension. Hypertension is a lifelong disease. Think about the battle that people have with cancer. Fortunately, many people surviving that battle. But cancer is not a disease where you come to the doctor, get a prescription, go home, and don't have to come back again. The diseases that we confront today are chronic conditions where the individuals with those kind of conditions must constantly get care. So the changing face of human disease coupled with the baby boomer demographic make it such that the way we practice medicine today and the way the delivery system is set up will not be the measure of what it needs to be 10 years from now. And I'm going to show you some data that suggests that clock is ticking. And that we need to be fast about the kind of reform that I think will continue to promote wellness, but also allow those suffering from chronic conditions to live a better life. So this concept of pursuing excellence by thinking more about quality and safety is really what I'm going to talk about today. Now, the healthcare crisis, if you will, is largely defined by virtue of the impact that healthcare has on the nation's economy. And this is a very famous healthcare economist, Victor Fuchs from Stanford University, who said if we solve our nation's healthcare spending, practically all of our nation's fiscal problems go away. And if we don't, then almost anything else we do will not solve our nation's fiscal problems. That's because healthcare today consumes 20% of the nation's gross domestic product. And as I'll show you in a few minutes, that rising cost of healthcare continues to provide an economic burden both to individual citizens, but to employers and to the nation. So we spend a great amount of our gross domestic product on healthcare. Now, people say 18% of the GDP. I find that a little bit vague because it means I have to understand what the GDP is. And unlike Rich, I'm not a commerce guy, so I'm not quite sure I know the GDP. But let me illustrate to you what 18% of the nation's GDP is. So today, that represents about $2.7 trillion. Now, trillion, billion, million, if you say it fast enough, it all kind of rolls trippingly off your tongue. But let me illustrate for you what $2.7 million really is. If I had a $1,000 bill in my hand, I don't, right? They don't make them anymore. But if I had a $1,000 bill in my hand and I laid it on this lectern every 5 seconds, a thousand, if I did that every 5 seconds, it would take 426 years to count out $2.7 trillion. So that to me is a little more stunning than 18% of the GDP. But here's what the real impact is that over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, that increased spending on healthcare has resulted in a series of ultimately untenable social choices. Because we spend 8 times more on healthcare than we spend on education. You know, the concern about K through 12 education in this country has less to do with teacher preparation and issues that we focus on, and more to do with the fact that we can't afford to pay teachers to be the kinds of individuals that deal with the complex issues that are in the classroom today. And we can't because we've decided healthcare has a priority. We spend 12 times more on food aid, and you can read this list. Whatever your favorite social choice is, it is simply being overshadowed by the expenditure, the rising expenditure on healthcare. So whether we recognize it or not, this series of social trade-offs has a series of consequences. And those consequences now are beginning to bear some consequence in our society. You may know that for the first time in a number of years, the President and the Congress passed a budget in November. For the first time since President Obama has been in office, that budget actually has discretionary spending increases. $40 billion for social goods and $40 billion additional dollars for defense. $80 billion of additional discretionary spending. Arguably, that has not been present in any budget to date. As you know, the budget carryovers have largely precluded any growth in expenditures. Where is that $80 billion coming from? Well, no new taxes. It's actually coming from projected cuts to Medicare in 2023 and 2024. Because Congress and the President decided no longer can the rest of society's need be subjected to the rising cost of health care. So you won't feel it today, but this budget increase, well overdue, will be balanced by cuts to Medicare almost 8 or 9 years from now, written into the legislation. Now, not only is there this macroeconomic impact on the nation regarding these social choices, but this is the consequence to an individual. So what you can see here is that over the last 10 or 15 years or so, healthcare premiums have risen year over year, almost doubling in that period of time. And in the yellow line, you see the average increase in wages. And for those of you that are employers, you know this trade-off intimately. You can pay the rising cost of health care as a benefit, or you can increase people's salaries, but you can't do both. And I would argue that the erosion of America's middle class is not a consequence of poor education and jobs. Certainly there are factors there. It is a consequence of the fact that the rising cost of health care have basically suppressed the wages of working Americans, particularly Americans in the middle class. Again, a subtle, not often spoken, but I think fairly sound unintended consequence of the rising cost of healthcare. Now, I mentioned this concept of the baby boomers, and that as one of two compelling factors that mean we are on a collision course. But of course, it is also equally important to say that the Medicare legislation, which was signed just 50 years ago, on July 30th of 1965, was one of the greatest pieces of social legislation in the nation's history, right up there with Social Security. And this is a wonderful image. I think a few of us in the room will remember. This is President Johnson signing the legislation, his wife, Lady Bird Johnson, looking over his shoulder. In the background, Vice President Humphrey. And in the foreground, Harry and Bess Truman. President Truman and his iconic wife, who were the first recipients of Medicare cards in 1965. And it's important to read, and I'll do it for you because the print is small, what President Johnson had to say on that occasion. "No longer will older Americans be denied the healing of modern medicine. No longer will illness crush and destroy." I can't see that far over. Way for a lifetime so that they might enjoy dignity in their latter years. No longer Will young families see their own incomes, their own hopes eaten away simply because they are discharging or carrying out a deep moral goal? It was an extraordinary piece of legislation. In 1965, there were 20 million Americans that became eligible for Medicare, and the average per capita cost was $280 per beneficiary. What has happened is this. Since 1966, that per capita cost has risen from $280-some dollars to more than $8,000 per beneficiary. That's that red line in the middle. And at the same time, the number of Medicare beneficiaries has grown from 20 million Americans to now somewhere around 44 million Americans. But between 2015 and 2025, that 44 million Americans will become 90 million Americans. And that's the baby boomers. And the fact of the matter is, as you all know, Medicare is paid for by a payroll tax into a trust fund. You all have, and many of you may continue to pay that payroll tax. And the concept was it would create a little bank for you so that when you turn 65, there would be your account on which you could draw to provide for your medical care in the future. All those trust funds for people in their 40s and 50s are largely being used today just to support the existing Medicare population. Never mind what will happen when that population doubles in just 10 years. So when I say the clock is ticking, this economic imperative driven by a demographic, not anything political, really creates a moment of significant crisis and a need for substantial reform. Now, this constitutes what would be the economic impact of that rising cost of Medicare on the nation's economy if something is not done. So you can see in this red line between 1980 and 2010, this is what the government spends right here on just four programs: Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and the federal debt. And you can see in the blue line, that's the nation's income, the federal government's income, the revenue that it has. And you can see in about 10 to 15 years, there's this exponential increase in the expenditure on those four programs. And somewhere between 2025 and 2029, the amount that the nation spends on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and the federal debt will exceed all total federal revenue. That means no money for defense, no money for education, no money for the forest, no money for clean air, clean water, no money for climate change. Unless we raise taxes. Please raise your hand if you're in favor of that, right? Okay, there we got a few. That's good. Well, I mean, that may be a solution. Or we figure out a way to control these costs. Or I guess we could borrow more money. That's another option. But this idea of kicking this issue down the road for our kids to and our grandkids to solve no longer seems tenable. So with this imperative, the people in Washington recognize the cusp of the crisis. But the strategy to date has been illustrated on the left, and that is death by a thousand cuts. So throughout the Medicare program and within the Affordable Care Act, an extraordinarily important piece of legislation, the cost of the Affordable Care Act is entirely borne, the expansion of Medicaid entirely borne on ultimate long-term cuts to Medicare. That's the strategy. Now, you haven't felt it yet, maybe just now, because all the cuts to Medicare that are designed to pay for the Affordable Care Act are back-ended in years 2020 through 2023. But there is this relentless plan to cut what providers get paid for services and what services are covered that begins to kick in about 2019, 2020. Just at the time that the doubling of the demographic will occur, the benefits will begin to be reduced. And that's because right now, the government only sees one way to honor the promise, and that's by reducing the benefit. And arguably, I would suggest to you, there is a better way. And that is to improve our way out of this by eliminating the existing waste throughout all of healthcare. Of the $2.7 trillion we spend on healthcare today, superb economists would suggest about $900 billion or one-third adds no value to our patients. Defects in care delivery, defects in care transitions, excess administrative costs. And so one could, at least in theory, through reform, reorganize in such a way that that $900 billion wasn't paying for things that don't add value, but could be converted and repurposed into dollars that could support the expansion that will be needed for the baby boomers. So this concept of improving our way out of this requires, and the reason why we're on the current tack is the government can only do the things on the left. To do the things on the right, you need a partnership between government and the provider community, us. Because the government can't go in and make those improvements. Only we can make those improvements. Only we can look inside our existing delivery system and say, this adds no value and it is costly and we're going to do away with it. And here are what I mean by the forms of waste in the system. The quintessential form of waste is harm, right? Please raise your hand if you'd like to go to the hospital and get an infection, right? The classic example of harm and waste. Overtreatment, when you get care you really don't need. Defects in care delivery, when you get the wrong medicine, or you get the wrong dose of the medicine, or you get duplication of tests, can't find the result from over here, let's do it again. Defects in care transitions, when people leave the hospital and enter a vacuum. And Marta and I were just talking about the critical need for UVA and JABA to continue to partner to fill that void in the post-acute care world. There's a huge opportunity there where we in the hospital have historically sort of wiped our hands and say, here you go. And for some, that's fine. People that can take care of themselves. For those that can't, those that aren't supported by families, those that don't have heat in their home today, those that can't afford their prescriptions, that is not a solution. But the failure to address that comprehensively, not in silos, results in those people showing back up in the hospital. A very expensive way to get a patient their medication. Excess administrative costs. What you pay for me. Arguably, if you're a hospital administrator and you're not adding value to patient cares, you're overhead. So each of us is trying to make an honest assessment of, are we adding value to patients? Because if we're not, arguably we're waste. Excess administrative costs in the form of delivering a bill to a patient. Only in America does it cost 19 cents to get a bill to you. And then please raise your hand if you can actually understand the bill, right? And then fraud and abuse, which people talk a lot about and is a focus of a lot of congressional investigation. It's a small fraction of the problem. These other five levers are far more dominant determinants. But here's the theory. If you could peck away at each of these things and perfect the delivery, you could save about $900 billion. And it wouldn't change any benefits. Arguably, you get higher quality care at the same cost. A value proposition. So how are we approaching this at UVA? The whole notion here of our health system is to execute on these five aspirational goals. to become the safest place to receive care. So no defects that harm you. No medication errors, no slips and falls, no pressure ulcers, no bloodstream infections, no catheter-related infections, no harmful events. To be the healthiest place to work. Part of the solution to the growing number of Medicare beneficiaries is to keep all of you healthy. To not have you incur the chronic conditions that oftentimes accompany growing older. To provide the highest level of clinical care, and I'm going to show some evidence of that, what I mean by that. But we call it Operation ESO, and that is, do we have the right expertise? Do we provide the right level of service? And what is one measure of clinical outcome that you would understand by which you could actually know you were getting good care? What do I mean by that? So if you've ever had to go to the hospital and the doctor said to you, you need to have a heart operation, it's almost an article of faith that you have to accept that if you're going to have that heart operation, it'll be done well. Well, what if we were able to actually show you the results of all the heart operations at the University of Virginia, and you could compare them to all the heart operations at Hopkins or wherever you wanted to go? Wouldn't that be a much better way to have a conversation about where you want to get your heart care, as opposed to the billboards, which says, I'm reputationally the best defined by who? By whom, I'm sorry, right? The fourth goal is to focus our research, our discovery, on the betterment of the human condition. One of the unfulfilled promissory notes of modern medicine is the fact that you, taxpayers, have $30 billion of your tax money that goes to the National Institutes of Health each year that fund academic medical center research. But we have not done a particularly good job in translating that discovery into treatments that affect humans. There are a lot of prizes, Nobel Prizes and Lasker Awards, and I'm the best scientist of the year. But that's not what biomedical research is about. It's not about me. It's about how is it impacting the human condition. So we are transforming our research portfolio so that every discovery is tracked over a three-year period. And if that discovery is not pointing toward something that will affect a human being, it's probably not something we should be engaging in. And then finally, this idea in which the senior center actually plays a key role of training the healthcare workforce of the future in teams. So I don't know if our medical student is here. This is great. Hi. But the idea that medical students probably learn more by being here than being on the seventh floor of the medical center where they're looking at liver transplants every day, right? Because that's what we do. We do a lot of very high-end care. But that's not what most doctors and patients need. So the idea of training medical students together with other healthcare professionals, which are present in environments like this, you know, the idea that I trained that the only place you could go to is the hospital, you know, you'd probably learn more at JABA than you'd ever learn on the seventh floor, just the way the world is today. So we got to think about how we do that, and I'm really grateful to the Senior Center for the work they've done with this, and thank you for being here. Aspire is a program funded by the Commonwealth Foundation at UVA where nurses and medical students are actually training together in their clinical years because those are the partnerships. Care is done in teams today. So I want to spend a few minutes telling you why I think safety is the starting point for this improvement methodology. And I begin because I think safety or its opposite harm, you know, it's unassailable that that's waste, right? When I asked about taxes, a few people raised their hand. When I asked about do you want an infection, I didn't see any hands. Harm violates a professional duty that we as healthcare providers have sworn. Do no harm. Above all else. Harm is the most elementary form of waste. I'm going to show you that. It adds no value whatsoever. And I'm going to prove to you it actually can be eliminated. It does not have to exist. So about 5 to 10% of people that come to hospitals, even today, acquire infections they didn't have when they showed up. That's about 1.7 million infections a year. About 100,000 people die in the context of that. And it costs somewhere between $30 and $40 billion of what I would argue is total waste. Now, this is to illustrate how healthcare has historically differed from other industries. On the left is an Alcoa aluminum manufacturing plant in Alcoa, Tennessee. So if you wonder how important Alcoa is to that town, they named it after the company, right? Why? Because everybody works there. Everybody works there. They make hot molten metal at 2,000 degrees on 10-ton cranes running along two football field-length manufacturing floors. And the average education of a worker in Alcoa's plant in Tennessee is high school. On the right is one of America's best hospitals, where the average education of a physician is about 24 years. So my question to you is, which is safer? To work at Alcoa, where they make hot molten metal at 2,000 degrees on 10-ton cranes, or to walk into a U.S. hospital? It is 27 times safer to work at Alcoa than it is to walk into a U.S. hospital. And this is the work of a single man, Paul O'Neill, who took over Alcoa in 1987, at a time when it had the worst safety record of any manufacturing firm in the world. Today, Alcoa is the safest place in the world to work. And O'Neill's theory was, if people get hurt at work, it is the ultimate form of disrespect, and it is human waste. And that if I can eliminate that, not only do I build a respectful workplace, but I can make my company more profitable, because sick workers can't make aluminum. And in this period of time, Alcoa went from being a kind of a moderate company to one of the highest performing American industries. Increased its market capitalization 800-fold while investing in one thing, safety. A principle that was lived out every day. And so what we're trying to do is develop that same mindset, that same set of systematic processes that eliminate harm in healthcare. So the way we've done this at UVA is called Be Safe. That's the initiative. Our Be Safe initiative is advancing our status to try and be high performing at everything we do, beginning with the elimination of things that no one wants, harmful conditions. Now, we've done a lot of work in the 18 months that Be Safe has been around. We've trained 725 frontline staff, nurses and nursing aides in lean system thinking. We've created 26 unit-based teams that are comprised of a doctor and a nurse that are the safeguards of safety on those units. We've actually hired 9 professionals from other industries who are lean experts. Lean is a business model that is designed to eliminate waste. And each of those 9 people are assigned to 3 UBLs. We actually have 2 Darden MBAs that are chronicling some of the benefits, the financial benefit of eliminating harm. We have 4 super coaches that are actually assigned to people like me, so that I stop thinking in the old way and constantly reminded about thinking in the new way. You know, at the end of the day, if you look at my schedule, every appointment I have ought to be adding value to a patient. When I began looking at my schedule, the amount of time I spent in meetings talking about things as opposed to acting on things, the lean methodology taught me that there was very little value in what people were paying me for a long day to do virtually nothing. But think I was doing something, right? Sit around, listen to things, have people come to see me, right? It used to be every meeting was in my office. Now every meeting is where the problem is, not in my office. So that's why I can wear my Fitbit now. I have a lot more steps a day because no one comes to see me. I go to see them. Think about the executive vice president showing up in the environmental services suite to have a meeting, as opposed to having those people drop what they're doing and come to me. The whole idea is leaders need to be where the problems are, being seen solving problems, not talking about them, not assigning them to somebody else, but seen solving problems where problems exist. That's the mindset. So I have a lean coach that has to remind me of that because that's not the way I grew up, right? So every week, my chief of staff looks at my goals, those five things, and looks at my schedule and says, your time didn't really reflect those goals. You need to go here next. You need to go there next. And then each of the problems we try to solve have to be solved in 90 days. 90-day coalitions. These aren't these infinite, long-term, you know, 3 years from now, it'll be better. 90 days. So how's this work? This is something I just want to show you. Please don't strain your eyes. This is called an A3. This is the lean methodology that we use. You define the problem. Meeting patient need is always in the problem statement. How do we better meet the patient need? You diagram how is the work currently done. You set a target condition, how we want the work to be done, and then you create an action plan. Who's going to do what by when and where? And this is available throughout the organization to be seen. We have a whole library of these where anybody can go see how one has rigorously attacked the problem. And every day at 10 a.m., all the senior leaders at UVA in the health system show up in what we call the situation room. And every morning, for an hour, we review things that went wrong yesterday. Anything that went wrong yesterday, from a nurse hurt his back trying to lift a patient, to a patient with advanced cancer died and we didn't get them to hospice, to there was a urinary tract infection up on the seventh floor. Everything that went wrong. Oh, by the way, do we have all the right staff? Does every worker in the organization this morning have the equipment they need to do their work? When we began this, just to give you another example, at UVA, all of you at some point have seen an infusion pump. This is kind of these things that look like dancing partners that people get hooked up to in hospitals that deliver medications, called infusion pumps. So at UVA, we had like 1,500 infusion pumps. Now there are, say, 500 beds at UVA. 1,500 infusion pumps in the hospital. And on any given day, we couldn't find 300 of them. So what would happen historically? We'd go out and buy 300 more. But let me tell you, there isn't like a black market for infusion pumps. No one's taking them home. But there simply wasn't a system to say, when you're done with the infusion pump, it goes here. And then it goes to the environmental services people to clean it. And then it comes back here where you can pick it up all ready to go. So we'd find them in closets in patients' rooms. We'd find them outside the cafeteria. We found one like checked at the door of the hospital. I don't want to take this home with me. I'll leave it here. Remarkable, right? All we needed to do was say, when you're done with it, it goes here. And every shift, someone come around and pick it up and take it here and retool it and make sure it's set and clean and then bring it back here. Then you say, oh, healthcare isn't going to rise and fall on 300 infusion pumps. 300 infusion pumps, 4,000 hospitals, many of them losing more than we're losing. And it's waste, right? God didn't ordain us to lose 300 pumps a day. It's not, you know, it's not some physical fact of life. It is just a bad process. Now, I'll tell you, roughly, 300 infusion pumps, $3,000 each, you do the math. So that's the kind of stuff we do every morning from 10 to 11. Half the time is spent understanding the problems, and the other half of the time, we, the leaders, go to the place where the problems occurred. So we leave the room where we're looking at all this stuff, and we go to the inpatient units or to the outpatient area where a problem exists, and we say, how can we help you to make sure this doesn't happen again? And we do that A3 work. So here's some examples of some of the work. This is bloodstream infections at UVA. So you can see kind of back in 2013, when I got here, there was already some improvement in our bloodstream infections. But from 2013 to 2015, and we put in BSA system, we've gone from about 72 bloodstream infections down to 14 last year. And I'll show you what that costs or how much that saves. And then if you look at urinary tract infections over the same two-year period, we went from 166 urinary infections to 21. We're on track this year to have 5 urinary tract infections through the first 6 months. And we're on track to have 3 bloodstream infections. Now, the year isn't over. Lots could happen. But I'm pretty confident those numbers will hold because the systems are now in place to make sure they hold. And we've learned a lot along the way. When you think of the 5 urinary tract infections that we've had this year, they're all in people that have something called a neurogenic bladder. They've had a big stroke or a big problem with their spine, and they can't void on their own. They need a catheter. It's not like you can take it out. So we've got to figure out, how do we perfect the process? We've done pretty well in perfecting the process for people that whose bladders work. We know how to make sure you don't get an infection. But if your bladder doesn't work, now we need to be innovative about how do we take care of those patients? Because we fixed all the other ones, now we're left with people that have bad bladders. So you can see how with dedicated systematic approaches, you can do a lot of good things. One of my favorites is the pediatric intensive care unit, where every day at UVA, extraordinary little 2-kilo miracles occur in an extraordinarily dedicated group of people. But little kids can't talk to you. And so when they get sick, you have to have very vigilant systems to pick it up. So over the course of that period of time, we've eliminated what were 109 infections. And remember, when you've got a 2-kilogram baby and you've got to give them an intravenous catheter, you have a real complex problem. Their skin isn't intact. Their gut doesn't work. Their immune system is compromised. They are a setup to be get infected. We've eliminated 109 of them. That saved 13 lives. It saved $4.27 million. That's enough to fund 9 additional ICU nurses for 6 years. Probably a better use of our money. We decreased the number of days in the ICU by 1,500. That meant we could admit 60 more of these preciously ill kids from throughout the Commonwealth to our unit. That's what happens when you say that's waste. It adds no value. It can be eliminated. And here's the good you do when you tackle the problem. This is an illustration from some work I did in Pittsburgh where we eliminated all forms of bloodstream infections and catheter infections in just 26 beds in an ICU, just 26 beds. So this was back about 10 years ago. We improved the operating performance by eliminating bloodstream infections by $1.2 million over 2 years, by eliminating infections associated with being on a ventilator by another $1 million. We eliminated methicillin-resistant Staph aureus infections, a very serious infection, so that saved another $295 million. Interestingly enough, Highmark, which is a Blue Cross affiliate, paid the hospital $3.1 million in a pay-for-performance initiative. Doing the right thing, they said, we'll give you some money. Well, that's interesting because Highmark is usually not in the business of being generous. So the question, of course, is how much did Highmark make on the deal? Highmark saved $11 million over a 2-year period in avoidable costs on this work. So when you say, how possibly, Dr. Shannon, could this save American healthcare? If that $11 million went back into the pockets of working people paying premiums to Highmark, or even if we shared it, you know, they get a little, you get a, that's the pool of money that would be available to fix the problem. So you don't have to raise taxes. You don't have to issue debt. You may have to raise taxes for other reasons, but not for this. Because there's $11 million of avoidable cost that was freed up in 26 beds in one ICU in Pittsburgh. So in 2 years, we improved the operating performance just based upon this of that 26 beds by $5.6 million by doing things that no one wanted. It cost us $85,000 of investment to do that. Now, I'm not much of an economist, but that's a pretty good rate of return. Thank you. We admitted 388 more people to the same 26 beds. We didn't build more beds. We used our beds better. And we saved 57 lives just by eliminating three classes of infections. Now, you say, Dr. Shannon, that's you, one ICU, one hospital, can't possibly happen. Well, this is from Pennsylvania, a little state just to the north of us. Pennsylvania has 163 acute care hospitals. Virginia, it's about 120, not quite as many. But in Pennsylvania, you have to publicly report all hospital-acquired infections by institution. So there's a public report, PHC4, and for a dozen years, when Governor Rendell was the governor, and then under Governor Corbett, I served on this task force, which was meant to chronicle and reduce the infections across Pennsylvania. So this is actually in 2012, and what you can see is there are about 2 million people admitted to Pennsylvania hospitals. That's the first column. And then you see below that that those 2 million people had 23,287 hospital-acquired infections. And you can see the different types of hospital-acquired infections. Turns out surgical site infections are the most common cause of a hospital-acquired infection in Pennsylvania. And then gastrointestinal infections, which are really infections that are called, that are due to Clostridium difficile or C. diff infections. Now, if you compare the outcomes of people in Pennsylvania that came to hospitals who got an infection compared to those that didn't, here's what you see. If you got an infection, your mortality in the hospital was 9.4%. If you didn't get an infection for the same conditions, it was 1.8%. Five times more likely to die. You stayed for 22 days in the hospital if you got an infection as opposed to five. You were readmitted to the hospital 40% of the time if you got an infection versus 16%. So you know a lot of work right now on readmissions. Actually, if you eliminate hospital-acquired infections, you do away with a lot of readmissions. And then here's the showstopper. It cost $20,000 if you had these conditions and had an infection versus $6,600. So that's a $13,000 difference in cost. And if you multiply 13,000 by 23,287, you get about $327 million was spent in Pennsylvania in 2012 on these infections. $327 million. So please call me back to the senior center when you want to have a conversation about what we could do with $327 million in Virginia. So it's not just one ICU and one person. Across an entire state, another commonwealth, significant amounts of money available to be saved. So part of this at UVA is changing the conversation. And when I was at the senior center a few weeks ago, we actually had an open forum in which we talked about the difference between the historical approach to this problem and our approach. So usually doctors and patients had conversations around what's the matter with you? The new conversation is what matters to you? What's important to you? Where do you want your care? How do you want your care? You want it at home? You want it in the hospital? Do you want it virtually? Do you want to Skype in? Do you want to travel? Do you not want to travel? What matters to you? And I would submit what matters to most people is currently unavailable in public reporting. That if you look at Consumer Reports or U.S. News and World Report or LeapFrog or any of those things, you can't actually figure out where to get your care. Because the data are unintelligible and they're not clinical. And that's why the most common place people look for a doctor or a hospital is Angie's List. So what if we made data understandable? So this is going to be our new initiative rolling out beginning in the spring, where we're going to publicly report to you our outcomes in real terms for common conditions. So this is the University of Virginia Medical Center. This is data reported through the American College of Cardiology. It's clinical data, meaning this is entered by doctors and nurses into data sets and then compared to 1,000 other hospitals in America. that are like us. And it's data as to how do you do when people have a heart attack at your institution. Heart attack's pretty common, regrettably still today. So you can see that there are, just take 2014, there were 328 people at the University of Virginia Medical Center that had a heart attack. Their mortality rate was 3.4%. Nationally, at 1,000 other hospitals, the mortality rate for acute myocardial infarction is 4.6%. So you were much better on average if you had a heart attack at the University of Virginia than in 999 other hospitals on average across the country. This is about the top third performance in the nation. So I don't want to say it's the best performance in the nation, but in the top third. Now, it's really difficult to get comparative data because Duke isn't sending us their data, and Hopkins isn't sending us their data, and Martha Jefferson isn't sending us their data. So I can't tell you how this compares to things that might be relevant to you. Ultimately, I think we have to be able to make those comparisons. But here's one thing I can tell you. Of the 328 patients that had a heart attack at UVA, about two-thirds of those people had their heart attack and came to UVA first. The other 115 people went someplace else and then got transferred to us after they got sick. And if you showed up at UVA first with your heart attack, your actual mortality was 1.38%. So it matters. It matters. But I would argue, and let me just say, this is a good example. I could show you ones where we're not so good. So I don't want to leave you with the impression we've got this figured out. But I think this is the kind of data we ought to be talking about. Not observed to expected ratios and all these dots on blots. I don't know where to go. But you'd have a pretty good idea. If you had a heart attack and you could get to UVA in a reasonable period of time, you got a 99 or 98.7 out of 100 chance that you'll survive to go home. If you come to some other hospital close by, you know, or in the area and you get sick and have to come to UVA, then the mortality is a little higher, but obviously that's because you're sicker or because care could be delivered quicker where we are, whatever the story is. It just gives you some idea. How about cardiac surgery? So here again, UVA belongs to a cardiac surgical registry, the oldest cardiac surgical registry in the country, the Society for Thoracic Surgeons. So again, 3 years of data. Let's just look at 2014. So at the University of Virginia in 2014, we did about 250 open heart cases for CABG, coronary revascularization, pretty common procedure. A lot of you have heard about it. The in-hospital mortality at UVA for those procedures was 0.8%. That is in the top 10th percentile in the country. Meaning very few other places, risk-adjusted in the country, can you get your coronary vessels fixed at surgery with this kind of mortality. And on the right-hand side, you can see that's the whole SDS database. And you can see nationally, if you have CABG surgery at one of 600 different hospitals, the mortality is 1.7%. So you're about half as likely to die following cardiac surgery at UVA as you are virtually in the other half of the organization of the nation. Now, again, I don't have comparative data. I can't tell you how it does at, you know, VCU or how it happens at Duke. We don't share that data. That's part of the problem. But I happened to spend 8 years at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, so I snuck their data. So at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania in 2013, the mortality rate was 1.8%. So you're about half as likely to die at UVA from the same operation if you had it at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Pretty good place, let me just say. Pretty good place. Now, I would argue these are the kind of data that are useful. I can't tell you these kind of data on every service, but that's what we're going to do. I want you to be able to know what your 5-year survival rate is if you have non-small cell lung cancer and you get treated at UVA. I want you to know that. And I'd like you to know how that compares to everybody else in the nation. Now, what we'll do with it is if we're not as good as everybody else in the nation, then we can improve it. We have a means to, you know, we have a motive to improve it. But if we are, we should talk about it. And not only should we be talking about mortality, we should talk about other things that matter to you. Like, when can I get back to work? When can I walk? When can I lift my grandson? What, you know, all those things that actually matter to you that we don't measure. But you can see, even in the cardiac registry data, complication rates. Really important, right? So you might survive, but still, about 35% of the time, there's a complication. And 37% of the time in the nation. So we're not an outlier, but we've got a lot of work to do to eliminate complications. Now, some of those are minor, but some of them can be significant. So mortality is one thing, but complication rates are another. Because if I go and have my heart surgery, I'm glad I'm alive, but I don't want to, you know, have an infection, or I don't want to have a blood clot, or I don't want to have an arrhythmia. So we'd like to start talking about these kind of data. You know, sharing publicly, here's what it is. And where we're not as good, then we can get better. But if we're not looking at it, we can't. So I'm going to stop, but I want to end with one final thing. The hardest thing in healthcare is actually focusing on the right problem. They're a sea of problems. So I'm going to tell you a little story. This is actually the transmission from a Canadian and U.S. naval vessel off the coast of Nova Scotia. And here's the transcript. The Canadians say, please divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. I know Rich is a big Navy guy, so, you know, I got a Navy analogy here. The United States ship radios back recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. Uh-oh. Negative. We insist that you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. The United States escalating. This is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. I say again, you divert your course. The Canadians. No, I say again, you divert your course. Now the ultimate escalation. This is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the United States Atlantic Fleet. We are accompanied by three destroyers, three cruisers, numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 1.5 degrees north. I say again, 1.5 degrees north, or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of the ship. The Canadians relay back, this is a lighthouse, your call. We do this all the time in healthcare. All the time. So the focused approach that we're doing is trying to solve for the right problem. So I'm going to stop there. I'd be happy to entertain your questions. I appreciate your attention and look forward to working with you to make all this community a lot healthier and a lot better. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, thank you for coming to speak to us today. First of all, you're brilliant to leave politics out of your talk, because that would have been, we've been here till next Tuesday probably. But my question's this. Over the years, I guess most of us have been used to healthcare on demand, small co-pays. Healthcare is something we think we just deserve. Now, what part of the patient's point of view could we do to make this more efficient? You can tell someone to go on a diet and lose weight. You know that doesn't work. When someone's injured, then they want to learn all about their disease and do something about it. But you got to grab the patient, I think, to be part of his own care to drive some of these efficiencies, I think. I'd love you to comment on that.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, I presented today a uniquely kind of provider-focused side of the equation. But, you know, there is this mutual relationship with patients. I think two things I would say. One is we need to recognize that you can take the American population and really divide it into four cohorts. About 50% of Americans are well, meaning they spend less than $200 a year on healthcare, other, you know, premiums aside, but out of pocket $200. The other half have either early onset chronic conditions, established chronic conditions, or have very serious conditions. And the top 5% account for 85% of the spending. So the sickest 5% account for 85% of the total spend. So if you're going to tackle that, you have to think of each of those quartiles uniquely in what those of you in business would think about as consumer segments. And you've got to begin to talk to people and have a dialogue where they are. Talking about chronic conditions to somebody as well, you might as well be talking right by them. So what we're trying to develop is this kind of consumer segmentation, where for the well, we have a series of important offerings that focus on their needs. And for the sick, there's a targeted series offering the forecourt on their needs. The second piece, though, that I think is very important is attending to the social and behavioral determinants of health. So I didn't talk about that. But when you talk about engaging the patient as the partner, understanding where they're coming from and what their home life is like and what they can or can't afford and what their social mores are is critically important to making any intervention. And we have largely been agnostic to that historically. So understanding the social and behavioral determinants of the health, learning about people's lives and what they need in community settings like this and through JABA are increasingly critical to understanding the needs. I don't think we've done a very good job historically, but we have to have those conversations, and our delivery system has to be focused on the different consumer segments. One delivery system won't fit all those needs.
So how do you get rid of infection?
Pardon me?
How do you get rid of or avoid infection?
So I think... what we do is, well, where we began was anytime there was an infection, we immediately swarmed the problem the day it was discovered so that we could capture all the things that happened around the patient that might have contributed to the infection. And then we committed to eliminating those things that we knew would be harmful. So one very important way to prevent infections is don't use as many catheters. So as it turns out, most people need a catheter following surgery because they get narcotics for pain. And when they get narcotics for pain, they can't pee or poo for, you know, a while. As it turns out, through a program called ERAS that we have at UVA, virtually no one gets narcotics anymore when they have abdominal surgery. They get non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs intravenously, and they're told to stay hydrated up until they show up at the hospital. You know, before you say, don't drink anything for 3 weeks before you come in, right? As it turns out, the best thing to do if you're going to be operated on is to come well hydrated. So you're allowed to drink whatever you know, Gatorade, water, not, you know, scotch, up until surgery. And being hydrated and avoiding narcotics means you don't need a catheter after surgery because you're not sitting there gonked out. So a simple thing like recognizing people got catheters after surgery because we're giving them too many narcotics resulted in eliminating about half the catheters in people following surgery. So if you don't have a catheter, you can't get an infection. And that's why right now we're solving the problem of if your bladder doesn't work, you need a catheter. So now how do we perfect that? But it's actually understanding the problem by looking at it and understanding its determinants and then clicking away at them. You know, it's taken 18 months, but that's a pretty big change in 18 months. And the change occurred beforehand, but it's kind of been accelerated because we're doing this kind of real-time learning. So suddenly, instead of people trying to take care of 100 infections, now you're taking care of 10 infections. And think of all the time that frees up, right? It's all benefit. So that's kind of an example. Yes.
Did you calculate lawsuits into your schedules? I know in Australia and New Zealand, you cannot sue, so.
You mean malpractice losses? Not in the economics that I showed, not in the P&L. Yeah, so I'll tell you an interesting story, because it's a very good question. So, you know, in that Pittsburgh economic that I showed you, that was actually about 50 infections, 50 people. And, you know, part of the learning process here is when someone has an infection, we disclose it to them. We say, you know, I'm sorry, you got this bloodstream infection, and it's related to this catheter we have in you. And every lawyer in the hospital said, don't ever say that. And we said, no, you know, you got to disclose what happened. So in the 12 years I've been working on this, where we've looked at hundreds of infections in patients, there hasn't been one malpractice suit filed. Why? People don't expect you to be perfect. They expect you to commit to being better. So when we're investigating these infections and we say, I'm really sorry this happened to you, but we're here to try and make sure it never happens again, and we're going to take care of you to make sure that no untoward consequences occur, people aren't punitive. They understand sick people are complex human beings. I have never once, in three different institutions where I've done this work over a dozen years, had a malpractice suit filed for a disclosure around a hospital-acquired infection. And it's the power of being transparent. People don't want you to kid with them, right? They don't want you to hide things. And if you explain to them, I'm really sorry, we're going to do everything we can to make sure this gets better, and we're going to work to make sure no one ever happens it again. They don't expect you to be perfect. They just expect you to care and to commit to making sure it doesn't happen again. So I really have stopped worrying about the malpractice stuff, because if you're trying to get better, people appreciate it. And recognize, healthcare is complicated. I mean, if you, I welcome you to come to the Situation Room any day you want if you want to see how this works, 10 a.m., McKim Hall, you're welcome to come if you want to see it in living color. But walk up to that neonatal ICU. It is just astonishing what those frontline staff do every day taking care of those little babies. It is astonishing. And when moms and dads see what people are trying to do, they're not punitive. They understand, but they want to be dealt with fairly. They want to be dealt with transparently. And so I don't make a lot of the malpractice thing. I really don't. I think if you're trying to get better and you're honest with people, most people are reasonably forgiving.
Question on that side.
Well, two things. One is, when you're in the hospital, you're usually seen by, I don't know what they're called, but underlings in the department. You don't see the actual doctor. Then sometimes you see him or her for 1 minute when they come in to shake your hand after the entire situation has been discussed. Yet, they're billed. They bill Medicare, and for a good amount. So what can you say to that?
Well, I think you a couple of things. One is, you have every right every day to require your doctor to be present to see you. And you have a right to make sure that the nature of that interaction is satisfactory to your needs. It is true at UVA, as part of that educational mission, we train residents and we train medical students. They are never practicing outside of the supervision of an attending physician. And I can guarantee that at UVA. Now, there's an advantage to having those young minds surrounding me, I will tell you, and I've been in this business for 30 years, is they challenge my thinking. I have with me, when I round a fellow and a resident and a medical student, that's six extra eyes to see things that I don't. And you know the greatest, I would never round without a medical student, because you know what medical students do? After I spend that 5 minutes with you, the medical students come back and say, is there anything else that you really wanted to ask that I can relay to Dr. Shannon? They are another set of compassionate eyes. But your question, I think, is more about, you have the right to demand who you want to see you when, and the nature of that interaction should be to your satisfaction. And if it's not, you should escalate that. You really should. But I wouldn't want that interaction, which might not be always positive or should be, but isn't, to make you think negatively about those trainees. You know, the cardiology fellow that rounds with me next week has about 22 years of experience, including 7 years since he graduated from medical school. He's a pretty skilled person. Now, he's not yet me, but pretty skilled person. And as I said, to me, what medical students add is extra time to come back and hear from you those things that maybe you weren't willing to say in front of a group, or you were concerned about, or to talk to your daughter, or other things like that. I would argue it's value added, but if it's not, you have a right to state that for sure.
But what
I'm talking about here is the charge to Medicare.
Right. So
where the actual doctor sometimes does nothing but shake your hand, yet you can see they've been paid a fairly substantial amount.
Well, the doctor collects the bill, but the team delivers the care. I think that's the way to think about it.
Do they get some of the money, too?
Sure. Medicare at a teaching hospital pays the hospital, not the doctor, pays the hospital a little bit more to cover those educational costs. Mm-hmm. But how else are you going to get new doctors? You know, I think Medicare was prescient in recognizing that there was an obligation to train new doctors or there wouldn't be anybody around. Now, whether the value is perfect, you have a very valid question. But the doctor doesn't get paid more. The hospital gets paid more. And the hospital then assumes the costs of the residents and the medical student training time and stuff like that. There are a lot of people that question that. I would argue, as a whole, the nation has been able to meet the growing demand of the Medicare population because of the expansion of the physician workforce that's occurred through that Medicare educational piece. But you know what? I think this is a perfect case. I would invite you to come over, and we should do one of these together. You should walk with me when I have those guys with me. And because I don't think, you know, in that one-on-one interaction, you're seeing the value. But I'll tell you, you know, I've had more residents remind me of things and pick up on things, more medical students saying, hey, Dr. Shannon, Mrs. Smith's daughter really wants to talk to you, that I wouldn't have picked up. I'll say one final thing. The safety stuff I talked about, the nurses are the guardians of safety. And the nurses are there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that work, extraordinary nurses. But, you know, it'd be fun if any of you want to come to the Situation Room, or if you want to come and, you know, we can do this together, I'd love you to see the value of it. But I understand your concern.
Dr. Shannon, you just talked about nurses, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the change that you have seen in your practice with the teamwork between nurses and physicians. You talked about nurses and medical students, nursing students and medical students working together, but how about nurses and physicians? How's that changed?
So there's no question. Given the complexity of the diseases we see, there is no humanly possible way that any single team member can manage the complexity. And so the intimacy between physician-nursing partnerships, physician-community health worker partnerships, physician-respiratory therapy partnerships has become enormously important. And thus, the opportunity to train people in teams. You know, to the point we're just talking about, you know, one of the real concerns about the demographic, the baby boomer demographic, is there won't be enough doctors to take care of the doubling of the Medicare population. There certainly won't be enough geriatricians. And there certainly won't be enough primary care doctors. Yet, from a policy perspective, we continue to beat the drum of we need, you know, 120,000 more primary care doctors. I don't think that's true. I think, to my comment earlier to Mr. Ewald, well individuals who need preventative care can be easily taken care of by a skilled nurse practitioner or even an advanced nurse. And we can have many, it's far more likely we can get nurse practitioners and nurses than we're going to get more primary care doctors. A lot of what primary care doctors do could be easily done by a nurse practitioner. So in our model, we see wellness and health prevention moving toward public health nurses and public health workers and nurse practitioners. And if you have an early onset problem, high blood pressure, and you just got diagnosed, that's what your family doctor ought to be taking care of. But a cold or the flu or a sprained ankle doesn't need an emergency room and an orthopedic doctor, needs a nurse practitioner that knows what to do. So I think the way to solve the physician, the quote, physician shortage problem is not to try and train more doctors, but to actually train more nurse practitioners. And that is simply an example of how important they've become in the discharge of care. Or maybe virtual care, right? So see the doctor by Skype.
Is there a difference in rates between for-profit hospitals and other hospitals? Seems to me there's a lot of pressure on the for-profits to, you know, have a higher whatever. And yeah. The other thing I'm interested in is, since we've had the so-called Obama health care, I mean, statistics before showed that there were 40,000 deaths on people not in in the prime of life for lack of health care. So how has the health care plan influenced these things?
So I think there is no question that the Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act has been a monumental piece of legislation. It has to be a right for every American to have health care. And the fact of the matter is there were 44 million Americans who did not have health care, and about half of those are now covered. But as you know, it is very state dependent. And here in Virginia, at least as of the moment, we have chosen not to expand Medicaid. As I was saying earlier, you know, there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. The gap in Medicaid in Virginia actually pertains to working Virginians. These are not people that are on disability or unemployed. They're actually covered. It's people that are hairdressers and cab drivers and waitresses and waiters and barbers, people that are working every day but whose salary simply can't afford health care. So I think there's oftentimes a misperception that these are kind of the down and out. They're not. Those people are actually covered. It's working Virginians who simply can't afford care. So I deeply believe that it is a right of every American to have affordable health care. And I believe the law is well intended. I believe the way the law was structured and the out year payments could have used a little more thought. But those of you that recall that legislative process, it was bolting the wings on the plane as it was going down the runway. And I don't think anybody really anticipated what were going to be the impact on the Medicare spend in those out years that was going to be necessary to pay for expansion. So I think the intent was perfect. These are complex pieces of legislation. I think there wasn't good thought into what some other, like these improvement methodologies that could be used to try and provide some additional value. Let me just say something, profit for profit. Every hospital is out to make a profit. We shouldn't use that distinction. You know, we make a margin on our business. It's what we do with the margin, right? So if you're a for-profit company, you make a margin and it goes to your shareholders. So if you're a for-profit company in Virginia, that money goes to Wall Street and then Wall Street distributes it to shareholders. If you're a non-for-profit, those dollars are typically used to be reinvested back in the institution. So at UVA, for example, our margin is used to support our residency training programs. We send about $25 million a year of the hospital's margin to the medical school to do research and discovery. So we take money we make and redeploy it in the organization. You know, margins in our hospital are made to advance our care capabilities. You know, we need new ORs today for the kind of things we're doing. We need new care systems in our neonatal ICUs. Those cost money. So it's just a difference of where the money gets reinvested, but every hospital has to make a margin. I think the only difference is for-profit hospitals send that margin to shareholders. We use it locally. I will say one other distinction, non-for-profits in general, but safety net hospitals in particular, like UVA and VCU, bear the additional social responsibility for caring for people that have nothing. So we have about $80 million a year, even with what we get from the state, of uncompensated care that we have to provide. 40 to 80 million, depending on the year. But a large amount of what our margin goes for is to help take care of people that have nothing, because that's an obligation. We're a state institution.
For-profit hospital put more pressure on the doctors to speed things up that might cause things to be missed because they have to keep, you know, yeah, seeing more people?
You know, I think from the argument I made about waste, we all have an opportunity to be more efficient. But if your question is there more of a motive to shortchange the interaction, I really don't think so. You know, I actually have had the rare opportunity to look at HCA, the largest for-profit healthcare company in the nation. They have one of the most robust clinical outcomes data sets I have ever seen. Across an entire nation, you can see what your cardiac surgical mortality is at HCA. It's a very powerful set of tools. So we're never going to get anywhere if this becomes you or me, he or she, them or us. This problem is much too big. So I try and resist the temptation to say I'm better than you are and simply say we all got to get better and quicker because it's 10 years before the clock really starts to run out.
So two more questions, and so we'll do one more.
Being tried, affordable care organizations and bundled payments and a lot of different things. Given your experience, do you have a sense of what innovations would make the most difference? And if you could design where it should go, what do you think it should look like that would really get us where we want to move toward?
So, Marta, as always, you made a really important point. In reform, people talk about the triple aim: higher quality, better service, reduced cost. But all those things you mentioned, bundled payments, value-based purchasing, accountable care organizations, are all payment methodologies. They have nothing to do with quality or service. Now, there's some measures that roll up into that, but I would submit to you, if we delivered perfect care, that is the right care to the right patient on time, the first time, without defect, error, or waste, the cost would come down. The outcomes would be better. So I don't like to start from the bottom up with payment reform. I'd say if we got better at delivering the best care, you'd save the money, rather than starting with a bunch of payment reform, because payment reform gets everybody crazy. People start to figure out the game. And it's really all about cuts. You know, bundled payments basically say, instead of paying $2,500 for your hip, we're going to pay $2,000. And you figure out how it gets spent, to me. That's really what it's saying. They call it bundled payment, but basically it's a cut in payment. That's going to create a floor fight. You know, for hospitals that aren't doing well, rural hospitals, those are death knells. You know, we just formed this joint operating agreement with Novant Health in Northern Virginia to largely make sure that community hospitals in North Central Virginia don't go out of business because they are deeply threatened by these cuts. So I'm just saying, take it from the other way. If you provide the best care every time, on time, without defect, error, or waste, the cost will come down by one third, and then you got the money. As opposed to, let's trick the system and figure out some new payment scheme. I think that just gets everybody off on the wrong foot. That's just my view. I obviously haven't convinced people. But we, you know, we spent a day with the White House Economic Advisors on Health in the executive branch last February. A whole day where we went through this idea with them, and including with the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And they basically just don't think they can get it done fast enough. So they've got to, they say, look, we love your idea. If we had 25 years, it's a great idea. We have 10 years. We have 10 years. And I think there's a certain sense of desperation. So we're trying as fast as we can to prove to them that there's savings that you could do. And if you did this everywhere, you know, if you save $4 million in every neonatal ICU, it would be a lot of money.
Before I give it to you, this is relevant to what you said. When you talked about what it costs per patient, et cetera, in the beginning, and you compare it to today, let's face it, we're fixing a lot more.
Yes.
But what bothers me is every time I see a big full-page ad about my x-ray machine and the $5 million building I had to build to put this $20 million x-ray machine, so therefore come see me, this is the kind of thing that bothers me.
Well, it's what I call reputational excellence, right? The billboard excellence. Excellence is defined by the clinical outcomes, and then you decide, right? Clinical outcomes are what ought to determine what you are, what the complication rates are. And ultimately, I should say, you should know what it's going to cost. We're not there yet, but we ultimately have to be able to tell you what it's going to cost. That billboard stuff, that front page ad stuff, you know, that has these sort of, you know, grand statements, I'm not so sure that's quality. I think we ought to be able to show you results. We ought to be able to show you results, tell you about cost, tell you about service. And that, to me, would be true transparency. And we're working toward that. We're not there yet. This is not a holier-than-thou speech. This is we're trying to get there. We're trying to move in that direction because I think those are the things that we have to do. Just to put that in, to put your comment, one more thing, Rich, in context. So why do you think the Medicare legislation set the age of 65 as the starting point for Medicare Trust Fund? Because in 1965, the average person was expected to live 3 more years. In 2015, the average age that people, you know, die in America is 78. That is, on average, 13 years more, 10 years more than Medicare ever anticipated. And it's for all the things you just said. There have been enormous advances. They've just come at a very high price. And now we got to figure out how do we make those advances come at an affordable price. That's all we're talking about. No one should at any point, you know, discount the improvement in health that's occurred. There's just a lot more we could do, and we have to do it in a more affordable, efficient way. I think that's a really, really important point. In fact, if you're middle class in America and you're a male, you have a 65% chance of living to the age of 80. If you're a female, you have a 75% chance to living to the age of 80. If you're a low-income person, those numbers are in half. And this is the social disparity, the social and behavioral determinants of health, that if we are going to have equitable health care in America, has to be addressed. Because you can't have people that have the means gaining the benefit exclusively. It just can't be. So that's where the social and behavioral determinants of health become really important.
We have time for one more quick question.
I just want to say that in this age group, in this age group, we didn't ask questions. We went to the doctor, whatever the doctor said. I'd like to emphasize that we have the right, when we go to doctors, I usually take a pen and a pad. I ask questions, and I write down because, you know, we've got to ask doctors questions.
I think it's very much the question I
had. Your point is very much the point that the woman in the back made about, you know, she doesn't want a hit-and-run visit with her doctor. You have the right to demand that. You know, you've said, look, sit down on the edge of my bed, hold my hand, and let's go through this because I'm paying you. If I were really busy, and I could say, look, you know, I appreciate that, but I'll come back. I mean, there's ways you can do this, but you shouldn't be subject to that kind of care if you don't want it. And secondly, you do have to ask questions. It's really complicated. It's really complicated. And, you know, that's why I love my entourage, because they can go back and answer all those questions and help me understand what I didn't do well, as opposed to me alone running through and thinking I did a great job and them saying, oh, by the way, Dr. Shannon, you forgot to tell the patient about X. I couldn't agree with you more.
Dr. Shannon, I want to thank you again for a great presentation.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.